From the state capitol, the Florida Public Radio Network brings you Capitol Report.
The clock is ticking toward the end of Florida's 2012 regular legislative session.
Wherever we fall out on the issues, I think the process is what's most important to ensure people's voices are heard and democracy is followed. And I think this has been a great session in that regard.
The Supreme Court says the new Senate district maps are unconstitutional, setting the stage for a special session.
It's part of the process. We respect it, and we're confident that with the information we have at hand, we can recognize their concerns and, most importantly, get those lines in place.
On a 2020 tied vote, the Florida Senate rejects the parent trigger bill, and a measure that calls for the random drug testing of state workers heads to the governor's desk. I'm Tramell Gomes, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. It's the final day of Florida's 2012 regular legislative session, and lawmakers are expecting to work late into the night. James Call reports lobbyists, reporters, and lawmakers themselves are on guard for last-minute amendments that make significant changes to state policy.
Lawmakers must pass a state budget before they can close the books on the 2012 annual legislative session. Questions about the spending plan for next year came up as soon as the Senate convened Friday morning. Here is an exchange between Newport Richey Senator Mike Fasano and Lake Wales Senator J.D. Alexander, the Senate budget chief. Both are Republicans.
Senator Alexander, can you tell us, are the conforming bills, are they available to be looked at and for any member of the public, are they now online or somewhere that we can observe them?
Senator 17, Senator Alexander, recognized.
All conforming bills were published. The last was published just after 6 p.m. last night. Earlier ones were published, actually some the day before. So there are conforming bills that are available as of, I think, right now.
Conforming bills are how lawmakers wheel and deal after the budget is printed and in a 72-hour cooling-off period before a vote can be taken. In recent years, they've been used to implement policy changes that either were not heard in committee or were defeated. Last year, senators revolted when about 50 conforming bills appeared on the final day. Such tactics are why during the final hours of a session, everyone appears tense. Amendments are another vehicle for lawmakers and lobbyists to slip a proposal past opponents. Here, Senate Democratic Leader Nan Rich briefs her members on a late-filed amendment regulating health maintenance organizations.
And it has to do with the University of Florida and provision of health and other self-insurance programs for the students, the employees, and so forth. And I think there's some issues with it, least of which nobody ever saw this before until the 59th day of session. But that's,
yes, thank you,
never
Senator.
Mind that.
This was out.
When lawmakers arrived at the Capitol Friday morning, 172 bills were still alive on their calendars. By noon, bills and amendments were bouncing between the two chambers like tennis balls while lobbyists and reporters watched. Observing the action was AFL-CIO spokesman Rich Templin. He characterized the 2012 legislative session as another chapter in the Florida legislature's war on the middle class. Exhibit 1 in his indictment is the proposed $70 billion state budget.
And look at the cuts that are being made to higher ed, raising tuition on working people. Look at the cuts in healthcare services around the state. You know, that is all directly because of the taxing policy that puts the wealthiest and most powerful people at an advantage over everybody else.
Lawmakers closed the nearly $2 billion budget shortfall with spending cuts. The state university system will lose $300 million, healthcare programs about $400 million, and 1,000 state jobs will be eliminated. Lawmakers also implemented hundreds of millions of dollars in tax cuts for businesses. Melbourne Senator Thad Altman says regardless of where one stands on taxes and spending, the legislature went about its work in a deliberate fashion.
People's voices were heard, issues were vetted. I think it's been a great session in the Senate. I mean, you know, wherever we fall out on the issues, I think the process is what's most important to ensure people's voices are heard and democracy is followed. And I think this has been a great session in that regard.
Once lawmakers close the books on the 2012 session, they are expected to return to Tallahassee quickly. The Florida Supreme Court rejected the Senate's proposed redistricting maps. Governor Rick Scott has 5 days to call lawmakers into special session to draw new Senate districts. The maps need to be approved in time for the August primary. For Florida Public Radio, I'm James Call.
The Florida Supreme Court says the Senate's new voting district maps are unconstitutional. Riga McCarthy reports today marks the last day of Florida's 60-day regular legislative session. But the Supreme Court's ruling means lawmakers will have to come back to Tallahassee for a special session to sort out the maps.
The Florida Supreme Court says the House voting district maps are constitutionally valid, and members of the House are pretty excited about it. Representative Will Weatherford, who led the redistricting process in the House, announced the ruling on the floor.
And on the very first page, I figured I would just read what it says. It says, "For reasons set forth in this opinion, we declare the plan apportioning districts for the Florida House of Representatives to be constitutionally valid under the Constitution."
The Supreme Court ruled unanimously in favor of the House districts, and House Speaker Dean Cannon says that's because of Weatherford's efforts.
You and those who voted for the maps deserve great credit. Those who tried to inject partisanship into it, those who implored you or others to cut corners, to not follow the Constitution that we all took an oath to uphold, and those who tried to undermine your efforts can realize today that they were wrong.
Meanwhile, Cannon says the Supreme Court ruled the Senate district maps violate the Constitution.
So we will need to plan to return in a special session.
The court used the same district builder software to review the maps as lawmakers used to build the maps. And in a lengthy 234-page court opinion, Justice Barbara Pariente says when the Senate plan is viewed as a whole, a clear pattern of improper intent is revealed. Pariente spoke when the court heard oral arguments over the maps about her concerns, which she says stem from the differences in the methods used by the House and the Senate to draw the maps.
The way it worked this year is that the House left the Senate alone, the Senate let the House alone, and they both agreed that whatever they passed would then go out on the joint resolution.
Senate President Mike Haradopoulos says the court's decision is disappointing, but adds that the Senate Reapportionment Committee will work as soon as a special session is called to address the court's concerns.
It's part of the process. We respect it, and we're confident that with the information we have at hand, we can recognize their concerns.
And he said he hopes the maps can be finalized quickly.
One of our other goals was to make these lines as early as possible, so if a person chooses to run for office, they know where they're running. And I think that's showing a lot of respect for the voters, and is also showing a lot of persons who'd want to put their, name on the ballot, be the best way to put it.
Haradopoulos says the process will be just as open and transparent as ever. Justice Pariente penned the majority opinion, with Justices Fred Lewis, Peggy Quince, George Labarga, and James Perry concurring. Chief Justice Charles Kennedy concurred in part and dissented in part, with Justice Ricky Polston joining him. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Still to come on Capitol Report, the Senate has killed a bill that opponents say was a thinly veiled attempt to pull the trigger and privatize public schools.
I just feel so sorry for our teachers and students. I think they are on an island in a sea of chaos.
Critics say not even the nation's revolutionary leaders would stand for a bill calling for the random drug testing of state workers.
Can you imagine if King George had told the Patriots that they all had to take drug tests and it sent an order over by ship to tell them that? I think they would have thrown the drug test right into the Boston Harbor.
And a talented artist turns the busiest spot in the Florida Capitol into a sculpture studio.
It's a way for me to kind of capture the history of what's happening in state government in the moment and then put it in bronze so it's around for a long time.
The Florida Senate has rejected a proposal that would have given parents a greater say in the fate of failing public schools. The bill had been stalled all week as opponents worked to gather enough votes to kill it, and as Lynn Hatter reports, after more than an hour and a half of questions and debate, the Senate made its decision.
After passing on a party-line vote in the House last week, a bipartisan coalition of senators found the 20 votes necessary to kill the so-called parent trigger bill.
Senator Beniquisto having closed, final passage occurs on the bill. Unlock the board and senators prepare to vote. Secretary, unlock the board and announce the vote.
20 yeas, 20 nays, Mr. President.
Supporters like the measure sponsor, Elizabeth Beniquisto of Wellington, argued the measure was needed to get parents more involved in the fate of persistently failing schools.
I take on this issue because I have faith that when given the opportunity and a real meaningful voice that parents will rise to the occasion and say, failure is not an option for my family anymore. Enough is enough.
But from the beginning, the bill has faced an uphill climb in the Senate. The parent trigger movement began 2 years ago in California. Since it's been in effect, at least two schools have tried to use it to trigger changes. But those cases are still being contested in court. And throughout the course of the debate, lawmakers like Democrat Bill Monfort said what happens in California should stay there.
Tell me where this has been successful elsewhere. I don't believe that we should get in line and follow California in anything, much less public education.
Eight Republicans sided with Democrats to oppose the bill. Among them was Senator Nancy Dietert of Venice. She questioned the bill's intent and said it wasn't needed. She also argued for giving earlier reform efforts time to work.
If you want to know what's the matter with public education in Florida, look in the mirror. We've been changing everything year after year after year, and we never give it time to gel. I will end by saying I just feel so sorry for our teachers and students. I think they are on an island in a sea of chaos.
Thursday, Senate President Mike Herodopoulos seemed almost to predict the way the vote would go, making note of the split within the Senate.
Well, again, on issues, when you talk about education, when you talk about insurance, these aren't so cut and dry Republican-Democrat issues, especially given where you live, given the circumstances on education, given the weather conditions or how hurricanes affect you, you're going to split in different ways on these type of issues.
And the chamber did just that on the parent trigger bill, similar to the way it also split earlier in the session on prison privatization. Included in both issues was Republican Mike Fasano of Newport Richey, who helped kill the privatization deal. Speaking on the parent trigger bill, Fasano said he couldn't get behind the potential for schools paid for with taxpayer dollars to potentially be run by for-profit charter companies.
What do we tell the taxpayers back home that built that school? Paid for the school. In fact, in many cases, we have bond referendums, referendums to issue bonds to build schools. And now we're going to take one of those schools and turn it over to a corporation that runs a charter school, and they make a profit off of it.
The lobbying for and against the proposal has been intense. The vote was delayed several times throughout the week as stakeholders counted votes and crafted amendments, some to save the bill and others to intentionally kill it. Supporters like the California-based Parent Revolution group sent out press releases with statements of support from prominent national Democrats and African Americans. But Florida-based parent groups rallied for its defeat. The Senate's main negotiator, Jack Latvala, who had originally opposed the bill, switched his vote after working to water it down in an effort to craft a compromise.
You know, if what we were talking about here today was the same bill that came over from the House of Representatives, I would be joining my colleagues who have spoken against this bill today. But working with Senator Beniquisto, we got a bill that's basically a pilot project.
But there's not going to be anyone flying that plane. Minority Leader Nan Rich argued with the opposition and characterized the proposal as a thinly veiled attempt to privatize public education.
Under this legislation, by the time parents become empowered, the school has been labeled as a failure, and their only empowerment is the ability to deliver their child's public school into the hands of a charter management company.
With a 2020 tie, the opposition managed to get enough votes to ground the bill for the session. But the debate over the parent trigger is far from over. About 20 other states are considering similar versions of the plan. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
You're listening to Capitol Report on the Florida Public Radio Network. I'm Tramell Gomes. It's now up to the governor to decide if state employees should be required to pee in a cup. As Sasha Cordner reports, a bill calling for the random drug testing of state employees passed in the Florida Senate on this last day of session, but not without heated debate.
When Governor Rick Scott issued an executive order last year mandating the drug testing of all state workers, the American Civil Liberties Union of Florida immediately filed a lawsuit, and the order is still tied up in litigation. But now the group could be gearing up to challenge a bill on a similar issue of drug testing state employees should it get signed into law. The threat of a lawsuit did not stop Republican Senator Alan Hayes of Umatilla from pressing forward with a more watered-down version of a drug testing bill to give state agencies the option of testing its employees.
It is optional. The decision will be made by the agency head. But if they do decide to have a program, the bill insists that the selection be limited to no more than 10% of the employees of that agency, and it be done on a random basis.
Should the agency opt to move forward with the drug test, the money would have to come from that agency's pocket. But Democratic Senator Chris Smith says that's too much to ask of an agency during times of cutbacks.
You're talking a cost. If an agency has extra money, please let Senator Alexander know, because we're cutting everybody to the bone. And if they got extra money, we need to use that somewhere else. We're talking spending more government money, infringing on personal freedom, expanding the role of government for no good reason.
Republican Senator Joe Negron crossed party lines to stand against the bill. He says he too sees no reason for suspicionless drug tests and adds even the founding fathers would have looked at the bill as pure government intrusion.
Can you imagine if King George had told the Patriots that they all had to take drug tests and it sent an order over by ship to tell them that? I think they would have thrown the drug test right into the Boston Harbor and would not have complied. I can't picture Patrick Henry and John Adams, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson agreeing to allow the government to test their most personal body and fluids to find out if they're using drugs or not.
But Republican Senator Evelyn Lynn says she doesn't know why anyone would even have a problem with the bill, calling it, quote, a simple little test.
What's wrong with having random drug testing? I can't imagine anybody being against this bill. A simple little test. You take it, it's over with, and that's the end. Unless you have something to worry about, in which case then you wouldn't like this bill. So this is a very good bill, and it's long overdue, and I thank you for doing it, and I wish that we were included.
Democratic Senator Maria Sachs countered that it's these, quote, simple little tests that will infringe on the rights of citizens.
You want to operate within the private business world? That's your business, and that's good. Do that. It's the American way. But once you become involved in government mandates, then you're encroaching upon the Constitution. A simple little drug test here, simple little drug test there. That's how we lose our liberties. We are still protected by the Bill of Rights.
Bill's sponsor, Senator Hayes, says what many opponents don't realize is that his bill could actually be a good thing for state employees.
Think about the preventive aspects. If we can help that employee who has a problem identify that problem early on, we're going to help them have a better family life, we're going to help them have a better work environment, and we're going to help them live longer and a better life. I think that we owe this to our state employees, and each agency head can make up their own mind.
The Florida Senate passed the bill on a 26-14 vote, largely along party lines. The bill now heads to the governor, who's expected to sign it into law. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
One matter conspicuously absent from the Florida House's final day agenda was anything related to PIP, personal injury protection. On Thursday, Governor Scott led a chorus in favor of the House version of a bill that supporters said would reduce fraud. But the House still had to wait for the arrival of the Senate's version of the bill before moving ahead on the issue. That had not taken place as this edition of Capitol Report was being produced. If lawmakers go home without addressing the matter, it's likely to return in a special session.
Now here's Ronald J. Eben with a look at some of the action around the Capitol on Monday.
Well, actually, Tramiel, there isn't any action. Mercifully, they've all gone home. Probably go home for a couple of weeks before they are called back for a special session. That special session set because the Florida Supreme Court decided that the Senate did not correctly redistrict the seats. The House got an okay from the Florida Supreme Court. The vote was 5-2. And so they'll be back in a couple of weeks to take up redistricting.
So we've reached the end of the 2012 regular legislative session. I must say we've enjoyed getting your updates each day, like setting the table of what to look forward to the next day.
Yeah, it was kind of iffy, but forecasting, because you never know what they're going to do. I mean, it's I mean, they could throw tantrums and walk out the door. You never know. Some things were very volatile this year. Some of the most volatility came from Republicans who were disagreeing with the Senate and House leadership, particularly in the Senate.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of internal party fighting and bickering, which
sure was yeah.
surprising compared to years past. The unity was like, you know, divisive.
There was unity in the House, and they pretty well toed the line to Dean Cannon, but over in the Senate, there was just a lot of rebellion.
Which is rare.
Yeah. Yes, it is there, although historically the Senate has a mind of its own. Yeah. You know, the days of Senate President Jim King.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he went his own way, and he took a lot of the members of the Senate with him.
A lot of action in the Senate this year. So next week, what's going on?
Well, not a heck of a lot. We'll be waiting from day to day to see what the governor does with these various bills. We know about some of them, and undoubtedly he's going to approve random drug testing, which was passed on Friday. That's the main thing. Day to day, what's he going to do? Is he going to disagree with something? Particularly, we're interested here in, at the University of Florida and Florida State University. What is he going to do with that bill that gives them the okay to charge as much tuition they want over the 15% that is allowed at this time?
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting to see. And then, of course, the universities are hit with a lot of money. Mellick cuts $300 million, $65 million for Florida State University. So they're looking for some additional tuition money.
So we'll be back to our regular broadcast of Capital Report, which is every Friday. And stay tuned to your local station for listing. Thank you very much, Ronald J., for what a wonderful and busy and hectic 2012 regular legislative session.
And thank God it's over.
Indeed.
And finally, for the past few lawmaking sessions, a true artist has been laboring in the fourth floor rotunda of the Florida Capitol. Tom Flanagan reports there's a reason sculptor Michael Jernigan is creating his latest project in one of the Capitol's busiest places.
The Capitol's fourth floor rotunda can be a crazed beehive of activity, especially during the final days of a legislative session. Lobbyists pack the marble-floored expanse between the main doors of the House and Senate chambers. Issue advocates yak on cell phones or gaze anxiously at the big screen TVs that broadcast legislative proceedings. From time to time, lawmakers will hold media events in the space. But in the middle of all the chaos, there is a small island of calm and creativity. A man dressed in military combat camouflage is sculpting a life-size head and shoulders portrait out of clay. The person depicted is also obviously in the U.S. Armed Forces. The artist is Michael Jernigan, who now lives in Tallahassee. He says being an artist was not a childhood aspiration.
I grew up in rural North Carolina and didn't see a real sculpture until I went to the senior class trip to Raleigh.
In fact, Jernigan was well into adulthood before he even tried his hand at sculpting. He taught himself out of books at the beginning, then studied under some modern masters. Today, his portraits can be found all over the Southeast, but most are in or near the Florida Capitol.
In the past, I've done my hand holding the Palm Beach ballot. I've done the donkey and the elephant in the pose of the Oscar figure. I've done Senate presidents and House speakers. So it's a way for me to kind of capture the history of what's happening in state government in the moment and then put it in bronze so it's around for a long time.
But a few years back, Jernigan took on a new project, his biggest yet. He's sculpting portrait busts of 21 members of the military. They range from former U.S. Forces in Afghanistan commander, now CIA director, General David Petraeus, on down.
Part of wanting to do this project is to make it all-inclusive so that I included the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marine, and the Coast Guard.
Jernigan says he starts working from photographs of his subjects, but the finishing touches are done from life. On this particular day, Army Captain Ricky Fitzgerald from Quincy, just west of Tallahassee, is at the Capitol for his sitting.
Well, it initially started out during our deployment. Well, before we deployed, we were mobilizing actually from the Capitol building here. He came up to me and he introduced himself and talked about what he was doing and what he wanted to accomplish.
Why did Jernigan select Fitzgerald for his project? Fitzgerald says it was something he'd said that wound up in the local newspaper.
Well, I was asked how I feel about leaving, and I said it was all about doing my service and completing my duty. And I think those was the word that actually pulled it over, so to him.
Captain Fitzgerald is still a bit awestruck by the whole thing.
It's awesome. It's awesome. First time I saw it, surprised me. It caught me off guard, just like I envisioned myself being.
Jernigan has 18 more works in need of finishing touches. Since the subjects are scattered all over the country, he says that will mean a road trip.
A company out of Goshen, Indiana, a Keystone RV company, has loaned the project a toy hauler RV that we can take around to each of the individuals now and have a final sitting with them.
It'll all be done in a few years.
The schedule is to finish the sculptures up by October 2013. And then have that 3 months for the exhibits to come together. We will then have the first exhibit at the top of the state capitol here, February of 2014.
A National Hall of Heroes, the creation of which has been going on in the middle of the hustle and bustle that is the Florida Capitol building. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Tom Flanagan.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are James Call, Sasha Cordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to the contributing stations along the Florida Public Radio Network. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance for Capitol Report, and I'm Tremel Gomes, inviting you to join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.